we're at the tail end of Parshat Vayigash, and Yaakov is coming down to Egypt. Yosef goes out to greet him. Gentlemen, this is a very important point in Kibud Avayim. Your parents come to Israel, you pack your kids up, and you go out to greet them. And even if your parents say, don't bother, you do it. And even if it means getting up at 4 o'clock in the morning and taking a taxi and going out to the airport, how many times will you do it in your lifetime? You'll do it 6 times, you'll do it 10 times, as many times as you'll do it. The message to your kids about what Kibud Avayim is, what it means to honor their parents. I remember as a child, getting up at 4 in the morning, going with my father, traveling to the airport, seeing the sunrise. It was those few times that I'd actually be up at 4 o'clock and see the sunrise. And I remember washing the apples, packing apples, so when they come off the plane, they'd have some apples to eat. My grandparents liked seltzer, packing the seltzer bottles, packing the cups, packing the food, getting stuff ready for them, so that when they come, we'd be there to welcome them. You teach kids what Kibud Avayim is. You teach them by showing them, by having them participate in it. Yosef is the prince. Let Yaakov come into Egypt. No, he personally prepares it, and he goes out with the whole royal entourage to greet his father. Yaakov doesn't just come down to Mitzrayim. Yaakov sends Yehuda in advance to prepare yeshivot. Whenever a person has to go somewhere, they should prepare by thinking in advance, how can I learn Torah when I get there? Where's the local shul going to be? People say, I got there and I didn't know where the Beis Medrash was, I didn't know where the mikvah was, I didn't know where the rabbi was, I didn't know where the shul was. Why'd you go? Before you go, Yaakov Avinu, before he goes to Mitzrayim, sends you, then he verifies, he does his homework, he makes sure he has that there. You wouldn't go there if there wasn't running water, you wouldn't go there if you didn't have what, you have to take care that you have what it takes. So sometimes it means setting up a phone chavrusa and partners in Torah, right? Sometimes there are other things we have to do to make sure. But before Yaakov descends to Egypt, he sends Yehuda there. He sends Yehuda to make sure there are yeshivot, so that his children come down to a place where they could learn Torah. Yeah, Yehuda sent with money, go, buy houses, prepare the place so that we have places when we come, we can go learn Torah. And there's a tremendous advantage to going to a shul. I used to go to Rav Moshe Halberstam Zatzal from the Eida Haredit to ask him questions, and he was a very unique human being. In his office, which was in his waiting room. So he's from the ultra-Hasidic sect called Eida Haredis. And in his waiting room, what? Mea Shorim, yeah. In his waiting room, you'd see kippot serugot, knitted yarmulkes and soldiers, and he just loved every Jew. And he had on the wall a sign, a letter from the Rebbe of Satmar. And the Rebbe of Satmar writes to the Hasidim, and he says, you will be tempted to learn Torah at home. Go to the Beis Medrash. You will tell yourself, nah, it's not worth the trip there and the trip back. I could utilize my time better learning during that time. Don't listen. Get up and go to the Bet Midrash. When you go to a shul, when you go to a Bet Midrash, the time that you're there is better spent. The people you see, you become a part of an environment. You have to go there. And I always tell the guys, when you go to Chutz La'aretz, go to shul. It's like hitting the reset button. You're in a different zone. When you're home, the TV's running, you're in a different environment. It's hard to connect to the Torah. Even if you're in your room learning Torah, you're not in that environment. You walk into a shul, you walk into a Beit Midrash, you walked into the environment of Torah. Yaakov sends Yehuda in advance to set up shuls and Batei Midrash so that there's an environment in Torah. When they come there, they have a place to go to learn and daven. Yosef goes out to greet Yaakov, and he weeps. And our tradition is that Yaakov doesn't say a word. He's saying Shema Yisrael at that moment. And at that moment, he's focused on something else. He doesn't kiss Yosef. So what does that mean? When Yaakov sees Yosef as king, so that moment, he is more connected to the Ribbono Shel Olam. When a person has moments of great pleasure and great sadness, those are moments where a person can really be one of two things. Very inside themselves or very connected to their Creator. Very often I say a line, Judaism isn't the problem, it's the solution. Sometimes a person says, I want to be happy, I want to be with my wife, I want to party. The halacha tells me this and the halacha tells me that. The halacha is giving you a framework that's beautiful. The halacha is giving you the way to really enjoy yourself. And the same thing in the laws of mourning. People sometimes lose a relative. I know a person that lost his wife and he wanted to go to work the next morning. What am I going to do with myself? No, sit shiva, sit for 7 days. If you go to work, then you're going to have mental problems. Sit down and think about what happened. Have friends come, talk about what happened, talk about the deceased. The halacha gives you the framework to deal with it well. And then move on with your life the way you should. So Yaakov Avinu sees Yosef approaching. And at that moment, so his focus isn't, oh, I love Yosef, let me hug him, let me kiss him. His focus is, Ribbono Shel Olam, thank you so much. You brought me to this moment. Even in the greatest happiness, he's connected to Shema Yisrael. So Yosef's excited and he kisses Yaakov. Yaakov isn't holding there right now. His thanks is to the Ribbono Shel Olam. Later on, he connects to Yosef. Our sages say he never kissed Yosef till the day he died. He didn't know what was he up to for 20 years. He disappeared from home and I get a torn, bloody garment. And who was he dancing with? And he sensed that something happened with Potiphar's wife and he didn't have a clear picture of how it ended. So we have two approaches among our sages. One approach says Yaakov understood everything. He knew what had happened and he valued Yosef. The other approach says he didn't have a full picture. Hashem never revealed to him completely what had happened. And so Yaakov always had this doubt. And Yosef either always kept the distance or always felt the distance from that moment onward. Or Yosef was always careful not to be alone with Yaakov for fear that Yaakov would start asking him, what happened during those 20 years? And he didn't want to divulge what had happened with his siblings. So Yosef, the next 17 years of till Yaakov's passing, will retain the relationship in a certain way to ensure that Yaakov never asks the question. Again, two approaches. One approach among Chazal is that in Yaakov's understanding, now that his spirit came back to life, he did understand. And that's the interpretation Rashi goes with, that he had the full picture at this point. Yosef says, I'm going to introduce you to Pharaoh, but you guys have to be careful because he might want to enlist you in his army and you shouldn't be there. And that's another important point. One of the keys to succeeding in Galut is to try and build an environment a Jewish environment. And that's what Yosef says. Let's all stay together in Goshen. That's where we belong as a people, and that way we'll strengthen one another. And Yosef brings his brothers before Pharaoh, and he brings his father before Pharaoh. When Yosef tells the Pharaoh that his brothers are shepherds, so the Egyptians have an issue with shepherds. How come you're leading our God? You're treating our God like an animal. Pharaoh asks Yaakov, old man, how old are you? What a disrespectful question. Here you see, sometimes when a person's in his high tower, in his ivory tower, he doesn't know how to be a decent human being. So what's he doing asking Yaakov that? So one interpretation says Yaakov looked just like Avraham Avinu. Yitzhak looked like Avraham and Yaakov looked like Yitzhak. They looked similar. And so when Pharaoh was a kid, he saw Avraham visiting his father, the Pharaoh. And now he sees Yaakov and he looks just like Avraham Avinu. He's dressed the same way, he's got the long white beard and everything. And he says, oh my gosh, how old you must be now. Another interpretation says that Yaakov's suffering showed on his face. And even though he wasn't that old, he was only 130 years old, but he looked like he was 300 years old. I don't know what 130 is supposed to look like, and I don't know what a 300. No. Yaakov will live till 147.
No, how long was the lifespan back then?
In that range.
In that range.
Yaakov Avinu didn't look his age. And he was aware of it, and Pharaoh was aware of it. He said, you look so old. I see your kids. How old are you? And Yaakov says, no, it's the suffering I've went through that's showing on my face. And Yaakov really, really suffered. Our sages say that he shouldn't have dealt with it this way, and he shouldn't have expressed it this way. Chazal say that, he expressed it in a way. He meant to say, I'm not as old, my parents reached much bigger, older ages. I look this way because of what I've been through. And Chazal sensed the nuance of complaint in what Yaakov was saying. And so Chazal held that against him. Chazal say, for every word he said in the sentence, he lost a year. And that's why he didn't live to the age of his parents. If you count the number of words in the sentence, you'll see that the number of years, the gap between Yaakov's life and Yitzchak's life. What? Yeah. Look, I don't remember. Yaakov takes care of his family, and this is part of his piety. His father took care of him for 17 years till he left his father's house. He will give his father 17 years of sustenance. A tzaddik tries to live a life of perfection. Whatever he's received, he tries to give back. And so Yaakov gives back what he's received, those 17 years of sustenance. Yosef makes Pharaoh the most powerful of kings as he buys up all the property and all the equity of the Egyptians. And finally, he sets up a tax, and he takes the Egyptians and he shifts them. By shifting them, he ensures that they won't rebel, even though they've lost all their wealth to Pharaoh. When you live in the same place and you have to look at the field that used to be yours, and you tell your kids, that used to be ours, this king, this Jew, stole it all from us, so then they'll hate him for it. What does Yosef do? He shifts everyone into cities. And now people don't even see it. They tell their kids, once upon a time we had a property on the other side of the country. What does the kid know from that? He grows up with the concept. We live in a city. We go out to the field. We're sharecroppers. We work for Pharaoh. And so Yosef does a phenomenal job of shifting the Egyptian mindset. Whereas they used to own property, now they're sharecroppers. And Yosef, in his taxing of the people, leaves the priests out of it. So the simple reading is, he didn't want to mess with the political party of the priests. What does he need them to form a rebellion? He leaves them separate. But our sages say two things here. One is that when Yosef was being persecuted for the allegations of Potiphar's wife, the priests were the court he was brought before. And the priests said, let's analyze his garment. And they analyzed the garment, and they saw stretch marks on the back, on the neck of the garment. They said, if he were trying to attack her and she was pushing the garment away, then his neck would be pushing on the front of the garment. We should see little cuts, little seizures in the front of the neckline of the garment. If his story is true, that he was trying to pull away and she grabbed the garment. So where's all the pressure being put? On the neckline, on the back of the garment. And you know what? We're analyzing scientifically this garment, and his version of the story is true. That's why Yosef got such royal treatment. Now, years later, everyone's being taxed. Yosef paid them back. Yosef said, I'm not taking their property. That's one interpretation. The other interpretation is Yosef lays down the infrastructure to ensure that the Jews, and at least the priests of the Jews, would be freed of taxes. And this would allow us to have an education system, even at the time that all the Jews would be persecuted. By freeing the priests from this tax, which no one could get out of, what Yosef really said is, the educators, the priests of the people, they get to own their own property, they get to be free of taxes. In the most trying of times, they're free of it. By laying that within the Egyptian culture and law, Yosef laid down the framework that would free the Levites down the road, that would ensure there would be Jewish education throughout our exile, that the priests, the Jewish leaders, would be free of the taxation, would retain ownership of their property. Pharaoh couldn't touch them. When Yosef shifts the people into a people that's all bound to Pharaoh, the leaders are not. The priests are not. He leaves them as a class in their own right, and this will later on allow the Levites to retain their status. The parsha ends with the Jews flourishing in the land of Goshen, a land that was owned by them because years earlier, when Pharaoh abducted their matriarch Sarah, he gave her as a gift the land of Goshen. So they were all settling a land which was legally theirs.